Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's like watching a PE teacher against school kids.
It is Friday, which means it's time for the Front Free Q&A podcast with me, Adam Boltwood, and the man, the myth, the legend himself, Chris Hennage.
Ah, lovely to be here.
Front two, big man, little man, A-ing the Q's, I think we say. Before we get into the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Hole of the Week. Thing is, there's no reviews this week. There's not been any reviews coming in. So I'm asking you guys to stop what you're doing right now. Click the link in the description of this podcast and review the Front Free. It's the first week of the Front Free being back bigger and better than ever. We've been doing regular podcasts, match reactions, trying to give you guys the best Front Free that we possibly can. So we'd very much appreciate some reviews. That'd be lovely. Jeff here, for example, on Twitter, Jeff Wall, was written in saying, "I just wanted to say I was one of the people critical of the direction of the pod, but I appreciate you guys trying so hard for the fans, and I will continue to listen to the awesome content. So thank you. Hashtag I am the whole." Jeff, that is very kind of you. And guys, if you want to get your reviews in on iTunes, please do. As I say, stop what you're doing right now. Click the link in the description. We'll still be here. You can come back, put us on pause, because it does help the podcast, helps us go up the rankings, all that good stuff, which we'd appreciate, because as I say, we're trying to bring the podcast back bigger and better than ever. And it'd be great to hear from you guys and hear your feedback. So yeah, thanks in advance. Right, we have to talk about Arsenal. Chris, last night they were knocked out of the Europa League semi-final in that second leg. Only a 1-0 win for Atletico Madrid, but from watching it, it felt like only one team was ever going to go through, and it was Diego Simeone's in the end. Not an overly impressive performance from Arsenal, given what was on the line for Arsene Wenger. You know, they wanted that crown and glory in his final season, but they didn't really come close to achieving that.
No, they didn't. I think I said as much on Twitter afterwards to someone that for me this was a game against a team who can really suck the air out of a match and a team that realistically needs an aspirin inhaler when they start walking uphill. I think that for me, Atletico, I think, have mastered the art of a really dogged, narrow performance. And they did that at Arsenal with 10 men. They did it tonight with a 1-0 win. And I think really there was a sense of inevitability about things that made it all the more frustrating. You know, they say that hate is not worse than love. It's apathy. And that was kind of the sense that I took from this, that it was all inevitable. And I think that is the worst feeling you can have.
Yeah, you never really felt like Arsenal were going to score. They sort of had periods of pressure in the second half, but the delivery from wide, especially from Nacho Monreal, was incredibly poor, which meant they couldn't capitalise on those chances that they had in Atletico Madrid's final third. I mean, Mesut Ozil is a player who's been singled out for criticism after the match. Martin Keown, in particular, very critical of the German. Do you think that's fair? I mean, I saw a little bit of contentious conversation online on Twitter, yourself criticising Mesut Ozil, a couple of people disagreeing with you there.
Yeah, it was one guy in particular, an Arsenal fan who, you know, doesn't think that because he's paid 350 grand a week or essentially the most in the team, that he should be singled out. I think, honestly, look, we do that with Pogba, we do that with Hazard. we talk about these marquee players and their ability to influence a game, and I don't think Mesut Ozil has done that. You can certainly say, well, if he wasn't on this much, you wouldn't say that. Yeah, definitely. I would not hold him to a higher standard than his peers. I certainly think that Ramsey was poor. I think Lacazette was poor to a certain extent. He was burdened by the fact that the ball was moving so slow in the midfield that really he was going to have to pull a rabbit out of a hat to try and get any space against Godin and just that entire Atletico defence. But yeah, I think that's one of the problems here for Arsenal, is that I think Ozil is a bit of a milestone for the club. Yeah, he has tremendous technical ability. He can spot passes like few other players can in the world. But there needs to be an alignment of stars for that to really work for him. And I think he's not the torchbearer or the leader that they need him to be. And I don't mean leader in the tub-thumping captain's armband way. I mean someone who will actually dictate things in those big games, in those big moments. And that's what they lack.
It's a stick that's often used to beat Mesut Ozil with, but as you say, it is asserting himself in these big games. He couldn't do that in this game. He couldn't impose himself upon the fixture. One player he did, though, Diego Costa, I think it's fair to say. Somewhat inconsistent in that first half, but in the second half, he was back to his best from what I could see, bullying the Arsenal defence. He looked superb. He linked up really well with Antoine Griezmann. And on the stroke of half-time, of course, getting that crucial goal, which meant the tie was essentially dead and buried. What did you make of his performance? It's been a while since I've seen Diego Costa, but here he looks superb.
Yeah, he did. I said to you before we hit record there that it was a bit like watching a PE teacher against a bunch of school kids. He was aggressive, on the right side of aggressive as well, because we know he can be firing. I know he had that clash with Mustafi towards the end, but you know that could have gone worse for him. If it had been a different day, I think he was able to link up with Griezmann really well. That was the key for me. I think was yes, he created a lot of chances for himself. He bullied the back line. He did kind of what you would want that target forward to do, what you think slash hope he will do against Marseille. But I think ultimately, what impressed me most was his ability to bring others into play. And I think that's actually something we saw at Chelsea, but I don't know if he always got a ton of credit for it. I think he got credit for being the bulldozer, for being the goal scorer, but his ability to bring others in and to help them maximise their ability, that was something I didn't always see him get credit for.
And it'll be Marseille. They play in the final of the Europa League. You'd have to back Atletico going into that one, surely.
Yeah, I think, look, they've had, what is it now, five, this is their fifth European final in 9 years, so they're sort of old hands at it, you could argue. The Champions League hasn't gone quite as they planned. The Europa League's been a bit better, but I think the talent they've got, the way they can just grind results out, the way they almost kind of stick a spoke in the wheels of a twig between the spokes rather of opposition teams, that to me is what kind of impresses me most about them when it comes to these big games. And I think you look at the way they've stifled Real Madrid. I know Real Madrid emerged victorious on both occasions, but they were a Ramos header away from winning first time round. If Griezmann's penalty's a bit better, maybe, you know, assuming things, they win that one. So it's been very fine margins in the Champions League for them, and I think that will put them as favourites for me against Marseille.
Yeah, 32 clean sheets this season for Atletico Madrid, the most of any team in Europe's top five leagues, which is sensational. Finally, on Arsenal, Arsene Wenger had spoken about how he wanted to finish his love story of Arsenal well and give it a fitting ending. In many ways, this does feel like a fitting ending to his tenure at Arsenal. Another limp defeat is indicative of how far the club have regressed in recent years under Wenger, and again a signal that change is needed, Chris.
Yeah, it's certainly not the way they wanted to bow out. I think Wenger said something along the lines of this was not how he wanted the love story to end. And I think, yeah, they were apathetic, they lacked invention, ideas. And it's such a polarizing turnaround to what they were under him at the start of his tenure in those first early chapters. And I think, look, Atletico don't do anything that I think is groundbreaking or maybe even that appeasing to the eye. But what they do is they win. And I think that's the difference here, is that you look at those two teams who probably haven't spent earth-shattering sums. I know Lacazette and Aubameyang have come in for a decent amount now, but if you look with a bit more sort of longevity and context to the start of the decade. They haven't really spent earth-shattering sums at Arsenal, and yet they haven't achieved a lot either. The FA Cup wins, you know, like it's, yes, it's a trophy, but it, at the end of the day, it doesn't feel like progress. I think that's the important thing. Whereas I think Atletico under Simeone, they've made progress, and you know, they've also moved into a new stadium. So you, for me, there are a lot of similarities you can draw, or parallels in terms of situation, but not in terms of outcome.
Let's move on to the questions then. Lots of questions coming in on Twitter. Let's start with Ben Davies. At Ben Davies, JFT96, tweeting in, is Jurgen Klopp one of the best managers in the world? Obviously, we saw his team progress to the Champions League final Wednesday night. I'm going to say that last bit again. On Wednesday night. Is Klopp one of the best managers in the world right now for you, Chris?
Yeah, I would say so. I think, yeah, the thing with him is there's a lot of Jurgen Klopp that I think is kind of rooted in the past, and I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean his style, it sort of lends itself to England in the 80s. It's aggressive, it's pressing, but it's sort of been given this varnish of modern intricacy, where there's a plan to it. It's not just people chasing after the ball or after the man in possession. It's actually organized and refined and has some detail to it. And at the same time, I think, look, the way he harnesses the past, he talks about the things that Liverpool have done, the special nights at Anfield, all of these kind of things. So often when we talk about the best, we think they're the best because they are reinventing things, because they are doing things that are new in the way that, you know, you look at Pep Guardiola, we talk about the new things that he has done. I don't know if Klopp has done that much new, and I think he's even said that himself, that a lot of his ideas are actually far from his own ideas. They're just modifications of the past. But I do think at the minute, the players he's got, the way he's worked that money, it's been fantastic to watch. And I think it'll only get better next year when Naby Keita and whoever else they choose to sign joins up.
Another question on Liverpool here from Packed Mouse. He says, is it fair to say Liverpool have had a better season than United, especially in terms of achievement and entertainment? I think that's a very fair thing to say, is it not? I think, you know, Liverpool could potentially finish outside the top four. I think it's unlikely. They've obviously they've played a game more than Chelsea, who are now 6 points behind them. They've obviously playing Chelsea this week coming. Chelsea have made up 4 points on them in the last handful of games. So I think that's going to be a really interesting game. But in terms of the entertainment, you can't really argue with that. Liverpool far superior to United, I think, this season. Apart from the Manchester derby, you'd say, which is obviously a fantastic result for Manchester United. And the achievement, like I say, it depends where they're going to finish in the top four. But at the same time, it looks like they are going to qualify for the Champions League. And to get to the Champions League final is an absolutely staggering achievement.
Yeah, it is. I think I know that some people will say they've had a fairly easy run to the final. And I believe actually we had a listener who talked about that relative to Real Madrid, that, you know, they'd face Porto and Maribor. And, I mean, Porto are top of the league. They're about to win the Portuguese league. So that's a bit unfair. Spartak came into this as Russian champions. So again, that feels a little bit unfair.
Yeah, Man City are no slouches in the knockout.
Yeah, I think Man City, there's no debate there that Man City are a great team. I think what I like is just how entertaining they've been. You look at Salah for 35 million, you look at Sané for 30 million. I'm always really careful about the comparisons I draw, because I appreciate that it can seem like I'm gaslighting certain supporter groups, but I think we've seen a lot of waste relative to big clubs and transfers, and actually I think Liverpool have been really efficient with the signings they've made, whether it's Milner on a free, things like that. Even guys like Gini Wijnaldum, who I think have been not earth-shatteringly brilliant since he got there, even managed to get out a tune out of him in Rome. So I think there's certainly a lot of stuff to be proud of, and that's before we even talk about Oxlade-Chamberlain, who, you know, again was very much dividing opinion when he moved to Liverpool for 35 million. So I think they've done really well for what they've tried to achieve, and I think they've played the market incredibly well, which is difficult to do right now.
Here's a question from Harry NUFC. Will Sunderland ever get back to the Premier League? If so, how long do you think it will take? It's a tough one. One day they could come back to the Premier League. I think if they do, it's going to take a very long time. They've obviously just been relegated from the Championship. Chris Coleman leaving the club as well. Although Ellis Short, the owner, has swallowed the debt the club was under. So it feels like, you know, potentially there is scope for a new owner to come in. That there could be good news on the horizon, Chris?
Yeah, I hope so for their sake. I think that's kind of what is being done now. The due diligence by the EFL is being done on Mr. Donald, and I think Sunderland fans are kind of doing the same. There's always going to be optimism when you get rid of an owner who doesn't really want to be there, which is definitely what Ellis Short was. I think what they're trying to work out now as a supporter base is what the next 12, 18 months are going to look like. In theory, they should absolutely piss League One, to be honest. It's not a sensational league. The quality drops. The financials drop in terms of how much you would expect to pay a top-end player, that kind of thing. You just need to look at what Blackburn did this season. They managed to do it fairly comfortably. Wigan the same, coming down from the Championship. So it should be totally achievable for them to bounce back up. Where I think things become a little bit more difficult is when you then get into the Championship. Because the thing with the Championship is it's such a moving feast, in so much as the year that Brighton, Huddersfield, Newcastle came up last season, you also had Reading, who'd been down the bottom of the league the previous season, Fulham, who'd been down the bottom of the league the previous season, and obviously Huddersfield, who came up. So the interchange between teams year on year means it's very difficult to actually find some consistency and almost supplant yourself at the top. I think that's where I see a little bit of difficulty for them. But I think if the planning is right, if it's thorough, I think if it has a bit of a leaning towards the academy, which is starting to produce some good players, then I think they can find success. But more than anything, it kind of needs to gut what is left of that squad, really, bar maybe a few of them. And I mean a few of them, like McNair, Gooch, Honeyman, and then start to sort of rebuild and get the fans on side and inside that stadium. Because I promise you, when that place is full, which unfortunately hasn't been very often these last few years, it is an electric place.
Here is a question from Mr. Walker Porter. Is defending dead, or are attackers simply more potent? Good question, referring to...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The trend of very high scoring blockbuster fixtures, I assume, in the Champions League, etc. In that leg between Liverpool and Roma, I believe it was the highest scoring Champions League semi-final of all time. 7-6 it finished on aggregate. Is the art of defending dead, Chris? It feels like it's less of a focus for certain coaches. I wouldn't say it's dead. I mean, we spoke about Atletico Madrid there, 32 clean sheets this season, which is absolutely phenomenal. But attackers, it does feel like the game is becoming faster. Attackers are more pacey and trickier to deal with than ever, which leads to mistakes, goals, etc. I'm leaning more towards, you know, it's the attackers becoming more efficient than the art of defending dying.
Yeah, I would be inclined to agree with that. I think it's easier to find good attackers as well at the same time as it is opposed to finding really good defenders. I mean, funnily enough, there was actually more goals in the knockout rounds by this time last year than there is this year. So you've actually seen a small drop in goals. But I think overall, the notion that defending is dead is not, I think, entirely true. I think what has happened is you've seen a little perfect storm of events. The one that we talked about there with attackers, defenders, but also changes to the offside rule have drastically influenced how a defender can use that and say an offside trap to their advantage. I always remember Ruud Gullit telling stories of Milan where the back four with guys like Baresi and Maldini and Costa Corta would play against the attack for 60 minutes and they wouldn't concede because they'd hold that line as if it was set with a ruler and constantly just catch people offside. Whereas now, if you're not interfering with the phase of play, you can pretty much stand wherever you want within theory, as long as you're not blocking the goalkeeper's line of sight. And that changes the way the defence operates. And I think it's almost instilled just a little bit of anxiety in defenders where they're really petrified to take a risk because one risk is a goal and a goal is, you know, potentially the difference between success and failure.
I think the evolution of fullbacks as well has a huge role to play in this trend. You know, wingbacks now are essentially attackers. You're looking at Man City, the champions, Kyle Walker and the returning Benjamin Mendy, for example. They're obviously contributing to attack in a big way, which creates more goal scoring opportunities, etc., but also leaves those gaps in defence, which in return can lead to more goals to the opposition. So it feels like, you know, there's tactical reasons for why potentially we're seeing this trend of more goals in games, etc., which leads to this argument of defending's dying. But certainly an interesting question, Mr. Walker Porter, so thank you for that. Another question here from RPM at Satchan. He said, Barcelona have lost just one game in the entire season. They have a double. Considering what the perception was about at the start of the season, this is a huge success, but it's still seen as some kind of failure for them. Do you think it's weird? We did speak about this on Monday's podcast, Barcelona's title win and how perhaps it felt slightly undervalued. If they do go the season unbeaten, perhaps that perception will change. But it does feel like a general trend in a couple of the big leagues in Europe, Chris. You know, Man City, Barcelona, Bayern Munich being so dominant, winning their trophy, their title so early, has led to this perception that perhaps it's devalued in some way because, oh, it was easy for them. You know, there's not that appreciation of the consistency. Winning it early is a sign of superiority, not a sign of, ah, it was easy for them. You know, we can't value that.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I feel like I referenced at the time what Brian Clough said about winning league titles, that it takes a bit of everything for managers. And I think it takes a bit of everything for players as well. It takes great bit of determination, consistency most of all, a lot of intangibles really that you can't necessarily quantify with statistics and numbers. I think the other thing that perhaps strikes me is the fact that for whatever reason there's a certain allure to the Champions League, the idea that, you know, you don't win it as often, or you don't always have the chance. You know, you have to get your stars to align for the Champions League to happen. Whereas with the league, for a team like Barcelona, every year reset hit and they've got a similar chance in theory to the last year. I personally think there's merit in both achievement. Me personally, I think in a lot of ways it's a different skill set. That's what you have to remember. It's a different skill set because for Real Madrid, you kind of have to turn it on just at the flick of a switch and ride through the difficult waves. And I think, you know, that for me, if we assume for a second that Real Madrid are to win the Champions League and Ronaldo is to star, I think that could be their legacy, that Messi couldn't always maybe turn it on in that cup-type moment, in that cup atmosphere, a bit similar to what he found with Argentina. That tournament sometimes did stifle him a little bit, whereas Ronaldo could. But Ronaldo couldn't always be consistent in the league and couldn't stretch it out across those 38 games and turn it on as much as needed, whereas Messi could do that. And I think it's a little bit of a different race for them both that I think is reflected in their clubs as well.
Next question is from Nikhil Dawood. Thoughts on Wilfried Zaha? Is he a diver? Is he ready to make the step up? Is he the most important player to any team in the Premier League? That is a big question. First off, is Zaha a diver, Chris? Yes or no?
It feels like a leading question, if I'm honest.
Yeah, a little bit.
I think he does go down easily at times. I do also think he's fouled a lot. The funny thing with him is I see a lot of this talk about he's the best player outside the top six. I have to be totally honest, and maybe I should be watching more of him. I don't always see that. I see a lot of really good runs. I see a lot of danger in him when he's got the ball. But I don't know if he would translate to a top six side as effortlessly as people want to make out. Because I think, and this is where I can be the stat man for a brief second and sound a little bit like Nico as well, and say that I would love to see what his possession usage stats are and see how often the play ends with him, because I think a lot of the ball is run through him at Palace, and I don't know if he'd have that same freedom. A bit like Memphis Depay in that sense, another winger who didn't really thrive at Man United because he had a high possession usage when he was at PSV. And it's difficult to go from being the star attraction to being just one of the band. That doesn't always work for players. Sometimes they can't refine their process to the point where they become more efficient with it.
Be interesting to see if, you know, he's long been linked with a move to Spurs, whether that potentially materialises this summer. You're looking at, what, 40, 50 million probably for Zaha that Palace would be demanding. So I'm sure Spurs would have to sell players the likes of Alderweireld, Dembele. They've been linked with moves away. Could that potentially fund a move for Zaha? Maybe Sissoko, if we can offload him for 20-odd million, we can use that for Zaha. I think it'd be great to see someone with that trickery, that pace, just that element that could change a game. Whether Lucas Moura is someone that Pochettino feels can fulfil that role next season, it'd be interesting to see. He doesn't seem to be able to trust him this campaign so far. But yeah, Wilfried Zaha, a player I'd long like to see at Spurs. So it'd be interesting to see if he can make that step up to his top six side. Moving on, we've got another question here from Brandon, who says, who has been the best young DP in MLS this season? I think you can take this one, Chris.
Still like really early doors. I know people are going to want me to say Zlatan because of what he did in El Tráfico, the LA derby.
Is that what they call it? But he's not. Brandon has said young DP. He has said specifically young DP, okay. Which is probably, I don't think Zlatan fits into that category.
So, then if we're going young DP, I think it's one of two, personally. It's either Miguel Almiron of Atlanta United, 6 goals. Granted, a few PKs in there, so, you know, not earth shattering. Or Jesus Medina of New York City FC, who's just come into the league. I think he's got close to half a dozen assists now and a couple of goals. So he's been fairly handy as well. A young player who they signed, I think he's Paraguayan. And so, yeah, one of those two. But it's, you know, that's one of the great things about MLS. It's becoming younger year on year, which is meaning you're getting to see more of these players.
On a related note, Matt Tinknell writes in DMing, sliding into those DMs out of the front frame. Started to follow MLS more this season, but want to find a team to follow support. Any tips? Who? I personally have got a soft spot for Atlanta United, having been there last year, having been to a game, not at their new stadium, unfortunately, but at the Bobby Dodd Stadium. The atmosphere was fantastic. They seemed like a club who had everything in place, from the infrastructure, from the way it was run, the youth teams, etc. Just seemed like a really positive atmosphere around the club. And yeah, I think Atlanta United, you could do worse than them as a pick to support in MLS. Anyone you've got a soft spot for, Chris, that you could recommend?
Whoever pays me to do digital work, to be fair.
Fair enough. Follow the money.
No, I think, you know, the funny thing is, it's not terribly dissimilar to picking a team over in England. You've sort of got to go with what you think aligns to you. So if, for argument's sake, you're a little bit more of like a country type, you know, plaid and stuff like that, then Cascadia, so Seattle, Vancouver, Portland, that's where you want to gravitate. If you're a bit more of a big city kind of you know, New York Knicks type, then NYCFC is probably your best bet. I think it has to kind of click with you, otherwise I don't think it's going to stay. And that's almost the trap I've fallen into, is that I can't really find a team that really resonates with me. I mean, DC United were the first one I was exposed to properly. And there's a certain allure to them, but I still haven't really found a team I've properly clicked with.
What's your perception of Atlanta?
You know what?
Nice kit and all. Nice bloody kit and all.
Nice kit, and to be honest, they've absolutely kicked the door down. They've not looked at the end of the league meekly, which I really admire. From the stadium to the players they've bought, the investment they've put in the team, the facilities, getting a youth team up nice and early. There's a lot to be excited about with Atlanta United, 100%.
Real life Gaston back on Liverpool. In your individual opinions, if Liverpool win the Champions League this year, could they carry that over and challenge City for the title next season? And perhaps this may attract a few big names. I think even if they don't win the Champions League, I think they could be challenging City next season. I mean, you mentioned it earlier, Chris. The likes of Naby Keita coming in, Mo Salah, I think there's no real danger of him going to Real Madrid this summer, whether or not Liverpool win the Champions League. I think, it's obviously been an incredible debut season, and I don't see any reason why Salah would feel like he can't fulfil his ambitions at Liverpool and would leave this summer. So it feels like, you know, they've got all the ingredients there. Perhaps they could add one or two more stars, but they've already got Virgil van Dijk, who came in January for 70-odd million. It feels like they've got a very solid spine to their team now. Karius is one who seems to sort of assert himself as the number one as well. So having him, van Dijk, Keita, Salah, it feels like a very strong core to build this Liverpool team around. So I think, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they can challenge City in the league next season, whether Klopp can take them to that level, because it's going to be more competitive than ever. Manchester United, of course, are going to improve, I imagine. Tottenham as well are going to be up there. Arsenal, I think, could, if they get the next appointment right, be a club that challenges again. You've got Chelsea as well, who are always revitalised when they bring a new manager in. So it'll be tough. There's going to be a lot of competition. But I think, for Liverpool, whether they win it or not, I certainly think they're going to be up there challenging for City and pushing them close. Next question is from... this is an interesting one. Simran Janda said, should Gerrard be given such a prestigious job as the Rangers one? He has zero managerial experience and has only been a coach for a couple of years. I know he has to start somewhere, but... very good question from Simran. Stephen Gerrard, according to reports, he may even be confirmed as Rangers manager by the time you're listening to this podcast. At the time of recording, the reports are all, it could be confirmed within 24 hours. It's an intriguing one, isn't it, Chris? Because obviously Gerrard is a huge name who brings awareness, who brings attention and a spotlight to Rangers as a club, at a time when they're, clearly second best to Celtic. But is it the right appointment when, as Simran points out, the experience isn't there? Is he really going to be the man to help Rangers compete with Celtic on a level?
I mean, unless he's going to start playing central midfield, I don't think so.
get the boots back on.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've had a fair few chats with Ross Dunbar, who's a good journalist and also a Rangers fan. And some of the deals Rangers have done have looked okay. I'm not going to start claiming I watch them every week. But, I thought Sean Goss was a decent little player at Man United that they picked up on loan, things like that. But the problem they've got is they're shopping in a totally different market to Celtic. You look at someone like Olivier Nsham, for example, who I was a big fan of at Man City. He had an okay-ish loan spell in Genoa before he went to Celtic. But I really liked him. Very powerful, very technical at the same time. And for $4 million, I thought, yeah, he's a bit of a bargain, really. I think he'll do really well, and you'll probably double your money on him at least. I don't think Rangers could afford him, and yet he would be such a huge upgrade to their midfield options, at least in my opinion. And it's things like that where they have to go and sort of shop in these side streets and things like that. They have to get, like, Alfredo Morelos and people like this from maybe outside of the box type situations, and I just think it leaves them in a position where, again, everything's got to be spot on for them to be a Celtic side who not only can shop for better players, but I would say have a better coach in Brendan Rodgers. and have just a better tactical identity. I think Rangers, Celtic, are so much more assured of how they're trying to play and how they're trying to achieve things and what they're trying to do, that it means that there's quite a little bit of a gap forming between the two, that means that I couldn't see Rangers beating them anytime soon, because in the brief glimpses I've caught of the Old Firm games, even I think when there was one where Celtic went down to 10 men and they still managed to beat them. So it was, yeah, the gap needs addressing, and I'm not sure if just Gerrard does it. I think they need some investment in there as well.
Tim Eales says, is Dave no longer on the pod because Liverpool are conquering all of Europe? Yes, the answer is yes. Question here from Harvey Hinkler. Who is the best manager outside of the Premier League in England?
Adam Boltwood.
Yeah, I was going to say Neil Warnock myself. But yeah, I'll take it. Is there any other legitimate shouts, Chris, for best manager outside the Premier League in England?
I'll be honest, my knowledge gets a bit hazy once I hit League One down. I'd heard good things about Shrewsbury's boss, but I think in the Championship, the managers that impressed me right this season have been Nuno, Espirito Santo, and actually Siklisa Jukanovic has done a good job of putting that Fulham side together the way that he has. I think it's going to be mightily frustrating if they don't get promoted one way or the other this season, but some of the football they've put together has been, it's been beautiful to watch.
So that is the end of the Q&A podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sending in your questions as well on Twitter at The Front Free. Do go and follow us there. Check out the new logo, the new branding, all that good stuff. And yeah, as I said at the top of the show, let us know what you think of The Front Free this week. We're back bigger and better than ever. We appreciate reviews, ratings, feedback on iTunes. You can click the link in the description to leave us a review, and of course, as always, be in with a chance to be in the Hole of the Week, our favorite review, which we'll be announcing once again from next Thursday. You do win a box of Ferrero Rocher if you are the Hole of the Week, so a very prestigious prize, I'm sure you all agree. Until Monday though, when we'll be back with the weekend review, as always, big weekend of football coming up. Chris, where can the Hole find you until Monday?
At The Front Three, trying to pretend to be everyone else.
Good stuff. Guys, do go for us there. Another plug at The Front Three on Twitter. Until Monday, we'll see you then. Have a bloody good weekend.
Three, that's a magic number. Three. It's the magic number. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, they stubbed me, and that's a magic number.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.